We are continuing on our walk through the book of Acts. Last week, Scotty shared from Acts 24 a message that's part of a trajectory, and I actually took this from his slide deck, but this idea that that Paul was in Jerusalem, and there was a mob that formed around him because they didn't like what he was doing. And on the other end of the spectrum is Paul in Rome, chained to Roman guard, and even in that circumstance, sharing his faith. In between, we have this section on Caesarea and a bunch of mishaps that happened to Paul, including a shipwreck. So that's the section that we're in, and we're in Caesarea. And here's a question that that you might ask yourselves. How would 2 years in prison for your faith impact your faith? How would 2 years in prison for your faith impact your faith? That's the conundrum that we find ourselves in Acts 25, where the Apostle Paul has spent the last 2 years in prison simply for believing and sharing that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. That's what landed him in prison. It's likely that you have not spent 2 years in prison for your faith. Perhaps you never will. On the other hand, you may be imprisoned by your circumstances. The chains that bind you, although not being made out of steel, feeling equally unyielding. And if that's you, that might help you to identify with what the Apostle Paul was feeling in this chapter. Now, Paul was an active guy. He lived a purposeful life. He was like a bird in a cage with his wings clipped, cooped up under false charges, his captivity unjust. He was locked up in Caesarea just because Governor Felix wanted to please the Jewish leaders. So if I were in Paul's sandals, or maybe if you were, we might be asking, God, why am I here? I mean, why did you allow me to all this to take place? We had a good thing going. I was sharing my faith in all these different places. I was helping to start new churches. All these things were taking place. Why here for 2 years? Why here? Why me? Why now? Why lock me up? So now, instead of sharing his faith, Paul's just a bargaining chip, imprisoned by a governor who had no intention of letting Paul go, trapped by his circumstances. Now, maybe you can't identify with Paul's circumstances directly, but you might be able to identify with being trapped in your circumstances. Why does God allow us to go through things that cause us to struggle, restrict our freedom, and so forth? And especially if we're doing his work, why would he allow that? Well, I pray as we seek that answer that the Lord will help us to remember that whatever our restrictions might be, the gospel is never chained. The gospel is not chained just because we are. And what that means for us is that our own unchained faith can flourish and even grow under trial. And even in our chained circumstances, God can continue to use us. We need the Lord to help us with perspective and perseverance, trials and chains, faith and kingdoms, and my prayer is that we will grow in Christian perseverance and in persevering grow in our faith. So here in Acts 25, we have a familiar storyline. This is one we've seen before in the book of Acts. Same old tricks, same old trial, and then figure out what the charges are going to be at the end of it all. So we'll start with the same old tricks. In Acts 25, there's a new guy in town. The new guy, his name is Festus. Porcius Festus. The old guy was Marcus Antonius Felix. So there's a new guy in town. He's trying to get his bearings. He's a Roman procurator, which means a governor of Judea, and he succeeded Felix, we know, in about 59 to 62 AD. So we know around when this took place. Who was this new guy, Porcius Festus? We know something of him from the Jewish historian Josephus, who in informs us that Festus was more fair and more competent than his predecessor Felix. Turns out that Paul wasn't the only loose end that Governor Felix left Governor Festus. There was a lot of unrest that took place during that time, and Felix had been a little bit of a corrupt governor, and so Festus inherited a little bit of a mess in this area. Turns out that Festus himself was relatively responsible, at least if you compare him to Felix. He represented the Roman authority in Judea, lived primarily in Caesarea. And by the way, there's two Caesareas. This is Caesarea Maritime, which would be on the Mediterranean. And Festus understood Roman law, but he did not understand the resurrection, which is what this controversy was all about. So our passage begins just 3 days after Porcius Festus took office, 3 days before he'd settled into the governor's seat at Caesarea Maritime. That's when Festus traveled to Jerusalem. Festus knew about the tension and unrest. The feeling of tension was palpable. We know, just to give you context, that about 10 years after all of this took place, the temple at Jerusalem and the city of Jerusalem was completely destroyed by the Romans. And the feeling and tension in the air was everything that led up to that point. So you can tell there's a lot of unrest that's taking place. So you would think that the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem would come up, you know, like the first, this is their first meeting, it's 3 days after Festus took office, and you know, like, what would they have to talk to him about? Maybe civil unrest, economic concerns, regional stability, administration of the region? No. They want to talk to him about the Apostle Paul. And that left Festus scratching his head, like, all this stuff's going on, and you want to talk about this guy that's already been in jail for 2 years? We might assume that the controversy had cooled, priorities had shifted, new issues taken stage. I mean, Paul was locked up, but apparently that was not enough. In Acts 25:3, they requested Festus as a favor to them to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem, for they were preparing an ambush to kill him along the way. So they wanted to, they're up to their old tricks here. Festus answered, Paul's being held in Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of your leaders come with me, and if the man has done anything wrong, they can press charges against him there. So we're going to do this at your place or my place, is what they're talking about. And Festus says, no, we're going to do this at my place. Let you guys come over here, and we'll talk. Now, the religious leaders at Jerusalem were up to the same old tricks, because if we go back to Acts 23, this is exactly what took place. They had 40 guys that were going to kill the Apostle Paul. Remember those guys? They swore not to eat or drink until that took place. I wrote down 40 men, a murderous plot, conniving with priests, voicing evil thoughts. The word got out about their wicked schemes to attack and kill until blood streams. The Romans heard they'd take a chance and made careful plans to avoid that dance. Are they out there still, that hungry crew who promised a fast until deeds they do? I think not. It seems they failed, for the word of God has boldly prevailed. And in that case, somehow Paul's nephew got word and shared it with Paul, and Paul shared it with the centurion and the commander, and so Paul sort of got out of that circumstance. And here we are 2 years later, and we're doing it all again. Same old tricks, and now we're going to work on the same old trial. So, same old tricks, we're going to try and kill Paul. We got a plan to kill Paul, but, you know, we're going to go to trial. Jewish leaders went to Caesarea. They stayed there about a week and a half before Festus convened the court with Paul standing before them. And our passage tells us that a crowd of accusers were voicing many baseless charges. They were all around Paul. Now, I picture Paul in my mind's eye. He's not been staying at the Hyatt. I mean, after all, Caesarea is on the sea, and if you had a lounge chair and a glass of lemonade, an umbrella, it might be a nice place. But for Paul, it just doesn't work out that way. He's under military custody, guarded, restricted, and watched. There are worse conditions that he could have endured. And as he has gone through his journeys, he has endured worse. This isn't Philippi's inner cell. Remember back in Philippi? But it is also more subtle. And it just goes on and on for 2 years. Paul has shelter, he has food, he likely has access to visitors, but he doesn't have freedom, and that is its own form of suffering. 2 years of waiting, 2 years of uncertainty, 2 years of knowing that Rome lies across the sea. And yet, here he waited day after day. Just after the new governor comes in, from Paul's perspective, we got a new governor, and then it's like Groundhog's Day. Anybody see that movie? It just happens over and over and over again. We're going to do this. We're going to do this again, thought Paul. He's like ready to lose his mind. Maybe you felt like that. Have you ever been in that kind of a circumstance where like things are repeating themselves? Sometimes when we're in relationships with people and in close relationships with people and things aren't working super well between us, if you actually analyze what takes place in your relationship with the other person, the pattern repeats itself over and over again. Well, here we have Paul. It's been 2 years, and he's going to go through the same circumstance again. And that is really sort of a hellish prospect. Have you ever heard some of the stories about Hades? Hades is the realm of the dead, where it's said to be a place that where there's no journey and no progress. A couple examples in Hades. Sisyphus was condemned to push a massive stone up the hill, and every time he neared the top, the stone rolled back down. Or you could be Tantalus, who stood in the water beneath the fruit trees. Whenever he bent down to drink, the water receded, and whenever he reached up for the fruit, the branches lifted so close, but he could never get the water or the food. And then there's the Danaids, who were condemned to carry water and fill a jar with no bottom. They poured and it drained again and again. You get the idea, zero accumulation. But however frustrating Paul's circumstances were in his situation, it was not like one of those stories. Even though it felt like one of those stories, it was not like one of those stories. He knew his life was not in vain, not because of self-confidence, but because of the God whom he served, even from prison. However frustrating Paul's situation might have been, he was not alone. He knew his life was not in vain, and he was not defeated. In Acts 25:8, Paul boldly declared, "I have done nothing wrong against the Jewish law or against the temple or against Caesar." Are those the words of a defeated man? 2 years he's been locked up, and he came out ready to talk to these guys. He may have been frustrated, but he was trusting the Lord, and he was even more impassioned about the gospel, his faith, and where he was at. What's curious, though, is beyond the boldness of how Paul came out, is the lack of detail in this passage regarding what was taking place here. In the past, in these sorts of trials, which had happened again and again, the accusation was something along the lines of, "Paul, you have been teaching people not to follow the law of Moses, you've defiled the temple," and so forth. And then Paul had his response that dealt with the resurrection. And so this is all in past chapters, but we don't really get into that this time. It's a little bit different. Something else is about to happen in this chapter, and it has to do with Paul finally leaving his prison for Rome. The new governor needed to secure the goodwill of the Jerusalem leaders, and so he looked at Paul, and Paul looked like a poker chip to him. He thought, oh, we can use Paul to help kind of placate these guys, and then I'll have some credit with them later on when I need to work with them on something. And so Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me there on charges? And it wasn't in the text, but I could audibly hear Paul groaning. Oh, you got to be kidding me. You want me to go back to Jerusalem? Didn't we do this before? Same old trick, same old trial. Jerusalem again. Last time, a mob had dragged Paul from the temple grounds out, and they had beat him. Last time, they had shouted all sorts of accusations against him, and the leaders were among the worst. Pointing that out would likely not get Paul very far, so he tried a different tactic. Hey, I'm not in Jerusalem. I'm in Caesar's court, and I'm a Roman citizen. I appeal to Caesar. Well, that appeal for a Roman citizen was the right of every Roman citizen. They could go and stand before Caesar on trial rather than in their circumstance. It was a guarantee that they may not get justice in Rome, but they're going to get a trial in Rome. And so it took the matter completely out of Festus' hands. Paul's declaration wasn't exactly the way he'd originally imagine going to Rome. I can't imagine that he imagined going chained and that he was going to have a shipwreck and all the things that are before him there. But he knew that God had called him to go to Rome, and this was the vehicle for that to take place. So in Acts 25:12, after Festus conferred with his council, he declared, "You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go." Now let's figure out the charges. So we've had the same old tricks, the same old trial, and we have a problem here because Paul has appealed to Caesar. Paul is going to Rome, and so Rome is going to say, okay, what are the charges against him? And Festus is responsible for coming up with those charges, but he isn't quite sure what they are. So although Festus no longer had to deal with the Jews, he had the problem of what will the charges be for Paul in Rome. Why, in other words, why has he been detained for so long? You've detained a Roman citizen for some reason. Why? So at this point in the story, Festus determined that he needed a consultant to help him with his conundrum. How would he find one? How would you find a consultant if you were him? You'd probably hop on the internet and say, consultant. Maybe you'd ask ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever those things are. Or maybe you'd hop on social media. I need a consultant. Anybody know one? And then you'd find consultants.com. And like, can I trust those guys? Or maybe you'd find Forbes rating on consultants. Well, back then, it didn't work that way. Back then, if you're going to find a consultant, it had to be someone you know. Like, I know a guy. And so That because it's kind of the I know a guy system, Festus is going, what guy do I know? Oh, Herod. Herod will be the perfect consultant for me. Now, you might remember Herod. There was a Herod that back in the day that killed a bunch of children in Bethlehem, and there were several different instances, all sort of villain type of instances. Herod, this is Herod Agrippa II. He wasn't the Herod that killed the babies in Bethlehem. That Herod was Herod the Great. Nor was he the Herod that executed John the Baptist. That was Herod Antipas. And this Herod didn't execute James either. That was this Herod's father. Being a Herod was sort of a family business. It was kind of like being king or queen of England. You know, this business has been going on a long time. It's a pretty good gig. But it's sort of the family name, the dynasty title, something along those lines. So this Herod was less powerful than his father. He was more tied to Rome, But he knew a lot about the Jewish situation, and that's why Festus wanted to speak with him. So Herod visited Festus with his sister Bernice. They arrived with all their regalia, which would be the royal display, the retinue of military officers, city leaders, all their people, all their stuff. They didn't travel light. And amidst all of this, Festus pulled Herod aside, and he explained the situation. So there's this guy, Paul, that's been left by Felix. He's been accused by the Jews who wanted him dead without trial. Festus insisted that there would be a trial and handled the matter expediently. And here's how Festus described the trial to Herod in Acts 25:18. When his accusers got up to speak, they did not charge him with any crimes I'd expected. Instead, they had some points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a dead man named Jesus, whom Paul claimed was alive. So Festus, he expected a political crime. Perhaps the prisoner had been involved in sedition or rebellion or inciting riot or threats against Caesar or some accusation about a dead man named Jesus who Paul said was alive. That didn't make any sense to him at all. Why put this guy in prison? And even if you put him in prison, why would you elevate this to the highest concern that you have when Jerusalem is such a powder keg? Festus continued in Acts 25:20, I was at a loss on how to investigate such matters. So I asked if he would be willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial there on these charges. But when Paul made his appeal to be held over for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. Now, Festus sort of left a couple things out, right? Like he was going to send him to Jerusalem and likely Paul was going to die. But, you know, that's okay. He continues on. And then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear this man for myself. So Festus replied, tomorrow you will hear him. So we can imagine it the next day. Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp and entered the audience room filled with high-ranking military officers, prominent men from the city. At the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. So you got everybody in their fancy stuff, all these important people, and then you got Paul, who is chained. He's the criminal in the situation. Festus explained the circumstances and set the stage for Paul's trial before Herod to determine the accusation ought to be sent to Rome. Remember, Herod's not determining what takes place next with Paul. Paul is going to go to Rome. The only thing Herod is helping to determine is what charges ought to accompany Paul on that journey. So next week, we're going to learn more about this particular trial. But what I'd like to do at this point is determine what the Book of Acts, chapter 25, has to say to us today. Now, what do you do with a narrative passage like this when it comes to personal application? How do we determine, this is all interesting stuff, but how does it affect me personally? Sometimes in Scripture, there's an example to follow. There are plenty of examples not to follow in Scripture as well. For example, we probably shouldn't be like Peter, who denied Christ. We probably shouldn't be like Judas, who betrayed Christ. Or remember that guy Abraham, who kept on telling everyone his wife was his sister? We shouldn't do that either. But in many cases, there are good examples to follow. And so in the case of Jesus, of course, it's a good example to follow. In this case, Paul is a good example to follow. So remember that question I said, how would 2 years in prison for your faith impact your faith? Paul shows us, though, that even though there are times when our life is restricted, and some of you know what I'm talking about, the chains that bind are probably not made out of steel, but they're equally as strong. And there's a reason why we're not able to move forward in the way that we'd like to move forward, even the way that we believe God is calling us to move forward, because there are chains that restrict us from doing that. Now, these chains could be financial, they could be relational, they could be any number of things, but they're situational. Somehow they're keeping us from being able to do whatever we would like to do next. And so what do we do in such a circumstance when the chains that bind? After 2 years in prison, Paul boldly appeared before the rulers in the region, even more committed than ever to the good news about Jesus Christ. And in his story, I'm reminded of the many saints who have subsequently handled their situation in much of the same way. Remember the guy Martin Luther? Anybody heard that name? I'm not talking about Martin Luther King, and I'm not talking about Lex Luthor and Superman movies. It's Martin Luther, okay? I get the right Luther here. Martin Luther was one of the key characters in the Reformation. But at one point in his life, he was in danger of being killed, and so for his own protection, he was kidnapped and taken to a castle where he couldn't do anything. He was hanging out there. And you know what he took his time doing? Well, he was not in chains, but he was essentially chained, restricted, couldn't do what he wanted to do or thought he should do or anything else. Do you know what he did do? He translated the Bible in 11 weeks into German. That was one of the key translations, one of the key moments of the Reformation. And it happened while he was in prison, while he was chained. And then you might have heard the story of Corrie ten Boom and her sister, who were incarcerated in a concentration camp during World War II. And they'd read 1 Thessalonians 5:18 to give thanks to God in all circumstances. And so Corrie's sister told her, you know, we need to give thanks for everything, even the fleas. And Corrie's like, why would we give thanks for the fleas? And finally she caved in. They God, thanks for the fleas. Thank you for everything you've given us. Thank you. Thank you. And later they learned that those fleas were keeping the guards away from them. Those fleas, although they were annoying at the time, were their protection. It's amazing what God's people can do while they're chained, while they're restricted, while they're free, while their wings have been clipped, their freedom is not what they should be. It's amazing how our faith can grow, and it's amazing how God can use us. So what are the chains that bind you? All of us have setbacks, things that don't go as we plan, times when we're uncomfortable, life-altering sickness, a wayward child, loss of spouse, or maybe someone that we hold dear is in prison, or we're providing care for someone we love, but it's really hard. And the chains can look different for each of us, and those restrictions can be in many different areas. But whether they're visible or they're invisible, one thing is for sure, they cause a lot of discomfort. And yet, as Christians, we can live in that space, and we can even grow. One of the lessons today is that even though we might experience chains, with an unchained faith, we who are bound are actually free. The world can chain you, but it cannot chain your faith. A related lesson in this chapter comes from the words of Festus, who was surprised about the nature of the accusation. He described it as a dispute about their own religion and about a dead man named Jesus, whom Paul claimed was alive. The Christian faith is all about the Jewish religion and a dead man named Jesus, whom we claim is alive. The law of Moses was fulfilled in Jesus, as was the purpose of the temple. The law was about how we should live, and the temple about the sacrificial system and how to get right with God. And the fulfillment of all of this that took place in Jesus is the crucial element of our faith. Now, some of us might wonder, in the back of our minds, is it really true? Because the two questions that come out of this is, if the Christian claim is true, does it matter? But first of all, is it true? And so there are lots of reasons to believe in the resurrection, lots of reasons that Festus could have heard. Scholars have examined it. Historians have debated it. Books have been written about it. There's an avalanche of evidence, including the empty tomb, the 500 eyewitnesses, many of whom would suffer and die for what they believed at that time. A transformation of fearful disciples into bold witnesses, and the early explosive growth of the church, which is why we are here today. Fulfilled prophecy, the early creeds of the New Testament, especially 1 Corinthians 15, written within a decade of the event, and the fact that Christianity did not slowly mythologize a hero over centuries, but it was immediate. And so there are people that could refute it, but did not. We could go on and on about the reasons why it's true, but one of the things that has personally been the most important one for me is the lives I've seen changed when people come to faith in Jesus Christ. I have seen amazing things take place when people have given their life to Christ. And now it's been years and years of that. And it's just confirmed what I already know is true, is that putting our faith in Jesus Christ changes lives for the better. Because God is not only in the purpose of creation, He is in the purpose of recreation. And He has done so through Jesus. And so Jesus really came back. And His really coming back made all the difference. Jesus is the fulfillment of the law. Jesus is the fulfillment of the temple. And I want to use another word, tabernacle, because in the beginning of John says that Jesus tabernacled amongst us, that the presence of God was in the person of Jesus, and He walked among us. And then another thing about when God gave the law and the temple, the law was sort of the conduct of how we should live, and the temple was what do we do because we can't uphold this conduct? How do we get right with God? So we're supposed to live this way, but we can't live this way, so we need to have the sacrificial system to make up for our lack. And Jesus says, well, the law is fulfilled in me. The person of Jesus is essentially the tabernacle, God with us. And the sacrificial system also pointed to Jesus because the sacrifices of animals only have efficacy in pointing to Jesus. That Jesus' sacrifice is what makes all the difference. When Jesus went to the cross, He did so to take all of our sins upon Him. Everything that we didn't do right, everything that we did do wrong, would be laid upon Him. And He died for us so that all of that could be paid for and so that those who put their faith in Him could be made right. And when we trust in Jesus, the picture of that is like Christian baptism. You go into the waters which represent your old life and you come out into the new life. It's a completely different thing. Not little fixes here and there, but a complete radical transformation through Jesus Christ. So it's one of the reasons why I think Christian baptism should take place as a believer. Should be take place when you're old enough to know what's taking place, as an adult or a child old enough to know what's taking place. If you've never been baptized as an adult or a child old enough to know what's going on, I encourage you to do so. It's really, really important because it's sort of an outward sign of what has taken place inside, and it's a public declaration of our faith. Some people are really nervous to get up in front of others and say, I'm getting baptized. But it's like putting on the team uniform and going out in the field. Yes, people are looking at you, but your declaration is that you're on Team Jesus, and it's really important that we do so. One of the questions that I have is, do you belong? One of the things that's wonderful about Life Spring Community Church is many people feel like they can come and belong to our church before they belong to Christ. And that's a wonderful thing. I'm so glad that we can have people here that haven't quite, they haven't put their faith in Jesus yet, but they want to have fellowship, and they also want to explore their faith, and this is a good and safe place to do that. But at some point that crystallizes. They're like, okay, now it's time to actually put my faith in Jesus. I'm going to trust in Jesus. I'm going to pray that, thank Him for forgiving my sin. I'm going to pray that the Holy Spirit's part of my life. I'm going to get baptized. And so there's a different sort of relationship. You can belong to a group of people, but all of a sudden you belong to King Jesus. And who you are depends upon whose you are. Belonging to Jesus actually changes our identity and helps us to grow in Him. Once you have given your life to Jesus and been baptized, one of the other important parts is just being a part of the church community. And so some of the ways to do that are to get involved in groups. We have the Alpha group, which is sort of an introduction to Christianity, and encourage you to go through that if you haven't. But there are many other groups that we have here at LifeSpring, and encourage you to do that. And then also membership, which is sort of like saying, I'm not just going to be staying at this house. I'm going to be a member of this family, which means I'll cook, clean, and do the dishes as well. Doesn't that sound attractive? But we also have a membership class coming up here as well. It's all on your bulletin.